I'm going to start with three definitions. Metaphor, the use of a word or phrase to refer to something that it isn't, invoking a direct similarity between the word or phrase used and the thing described. Analogy, a relationship of resemblance or equivalence between two situations, people, or objects, especially when used as a basis for explanation or extrapolation. I share these because of the third definition, overused. Used too much and too often. I'll be doing that today. We use an analogy or metaphor to make a point. When it works, it gets overused until it's no longer immediately compelling. In fact, it begins to seem obvious. It's interesting, however, to think back to the first time you heard what you now think of as a cliche, and recall that back then, it quite possibly seemed striking. Humans are often likened to computers, as if we were just some sort of central processing unit with random access memory in both local and remote storage. This seems awfully trite, and it makes some of us uncomfortable for various reasons. It also often seems to be too true of a comparison for us to reject. In the mid-70s, an architect named Christopher Alexander proposed a novel way of looking at design. Architects don't design buildings, bridges, cities. Architects design solutions to problems. All of design, suggested Alexander, was the attempt to solve a set of problems in a multitude of ways. All of design could be boiled down to a small set of specific problems, and a language could be developed which would describe any solution to any problem. How do you keep yourself and your plate from sitting on the floor while eating dinner? Patterns give us chairs and stools, tables, counters, and shelves to place our plates and or our behinds on. How many legs does a stool have? A table? Different patterns may specify different numbers, but all solve the same essential problem. Alexander's ideas mostly failed to catch on. Either this distilling of an individual art into something shared and somehow less arty was unappealing to, or just too obscure, for the rest of the architectural world to adopt. Interestingly, his ideas have found a devoted following in information technology. The idea of a general, reusable solution to a commonly occurring problem is very appealing to programmers. The patterns don't provide a shortcut to finished software, not by any stretch, nor do they provide, or they do provide, a description or a template of how that program could be constructed. You know, sort of a head start in producing that program. In my job where I work as a network engineer, when I'm working on a design, I frequently make use of this concept of patterns to help make sense of the various overhyped sales pitches that vendors give me to solve my problems. I can see why architects didn't like this idea very much when I'd reduce an hour-long presentation, long stream of marketing drivel, down to three small boxes and a couple of arrows on a whiteboard. Most of the vendors turn out to have the same pattern underlying their solution and are trying to convince me their solution is somehow better because of whatever isn't part of the solution. They don't like that. When a programmer is trying to develop a piece of new software, she might save herself some trouble by looking at how others before her have solved similar problems. Not to steal or reuse their solution, but to grasp the underlying design principles and see if she can find a way to solve a problem better than those who went before. So much for the esoteric worlds of architecture and computer science. How does this idea play in our lives? Surprisingly well. Think of a three-year-old you've known. No, not the happy memory where everything went well. Look at the tense moment when that child first realized things weren't going their way. What did the child in your memory do to get control of that situation? The stories most of you could tell right now, and a few of you are already whispering, are really quite varied, but I'll suggest that we could boil them down, just like Alexander did with design, to just a few basic solutions or patterns of behavior used to solve the general problem. There are quite a few problems which three-year-olds face, and not a large set of common solution patterns. The list is short. It includes, but is not limited to, yelling, crying, begging to get back control, or perhaps the more creative might try to change what they wanted so they could seem to have been in control all along. You've all seen a young child with a hammer. Suddenly everything needs banging as if the entire world had turned into nails. If we think about that pattern for solving the not getting my way problem, like a hammer, it's not that much of a stretch to see that the child will use that tool over and over again, solving all of their problems with the hammer. I'll give you the analogy of a toolbox. The first time you find a tool which works on a problem, that tool goes in the toolbox. The next time a problem crops up, check the toolbox. Use that tool again and again. Whenever you find a problem, hit it with a hammer. This will work surprisingly well for a long time. But eventually you'll run into a problem which cannot be solved with the hammer, and you'll have to work out a new tool. The analogy breaks here because it's hard to liken social problems, social solutions, to screwdrivers and saw blades, or where's Bill? The jaws of life aren't going to work real well in this analogy. So I'll just stick with hammers. In many conversations with people I've trotted this idea out with, we've observed that most people needed their first problem-solving tool or pattern in early childhood and probably got by with that one tool until puberty set in. It makes sense that the whole hormonal blood-boiling, brain-rewiring thing that goes on would throw your old patterns out of whack as well. So often, a teenager will need to add to their toolbox, solving a problem not likely to have confronted the three-year-old to continue their way in the world. Once the brain and body start to settle, and that teen has gotten pretty good at using tool number two, whenever number one failed to work, life changes the rules again, and they go to college or they move out, and there are many new problems. Quite probably they'll be confronted by something which neither the childhood tool nor the teen solution works for, and they need a third tool. If you want evidence that this model for human interpersonal relationships fits whatever's really happening in our heads, look at office life. Have you ever had a boss or a coworker who relied on yelling or doing it themselves? Or telling HR? That works in nearly every situation. Most people never need more than two tools and only occasionally need that third one to solve their problems. As far as I can see, most people go through life using their three-year-old tools and their teen patterns for solving their adult problems, never having needed to come up with anything else. These tools we develop work to get us over and through our problems, but they're seldom satisfying. In architecture, the pattern for a chair actually solves the problem of where to sit. In computer science, the pattern actually makes the problem go away. In human interactions, we're hampered by memory. So the pattern may solve the problem, but the problem situation remains in memory. We can look back on the problem and see that the solution wasn't necessarily good for all parties, or look forward and see that the solution might have dire consequences in the future. Worse, we can look back whenever we like, and we can see that there was a problem to begin with and get all worked up over again. I can't help with the last one, but I've got some ideas for problem-solving improvements. I've been studying myself over time, I've picked up my most frequently used solutions to problems. Generally speaking, these three patterns solve most of my problems. Also, in general, I dislike the solution they provide when I use them on autopilot. If I let myself hit everything, I'll be fairly happy with my effect on nails. But breaking everything else, not so pleasant. Now that I can see the patterns I fall back on, I've been practicing stopping myself to check to determine which of the three tools will work best, or if I'll actually have to work out a new tool or solution to a problem. It's not often as easy as it sounds to say that. The solution's often much messier, but I usually like the solution better. If one of my tools is the right tool to use, I use it on purpose, and I focus it on only what needs the metaphorical hitting. Or I'll use my tools to buy time while I invent that actual solution. Whenever I'm confronted, I try one of these three things. I hide. Not usually to crawl under the covers and hope the world will leave me alone sense, although that occurred to me this last week preparing to speak to you guys. And on autopilot, I hide by looking like I'm trying to be involved, but sneakily trying to avoid it. Did you know, if you're afraid to make telephone calls, cold calls, that sort of thing, you can call lots and lots of people during dinner, and they won't pick up. I can't say I've actually found a really good use for hiding when I use it on purpose, but I'll think of one. My second solution to most problems is to know everything. I just do. On autopilot, I can get people to leave me alone because I know more than they do or better than they do, and generally speaking, make them feel bad about asking me questions or bothering me. It works perfectly. My problem goes away. Seldom solved, usually away. On purpose, I can use this. I can help people out by knowing exactly what it is we need to do to solve their problems, even if sometimes all I really know is enough to ask the right questions. My third tool for use is I become increasingly reasonable. I can take whatever is happening around me in stride, act like it's all normal and going exactly the way it should. On autopilot, I use this to convince people around me that they're the ones being silly or wrong or getting all worked up over something unnecessarily. And it's not really a problem. On purpose, I can use this to help people around me become calmer and address the situation in a way that arrives at a solution that they like, or I like, or both, to more easily look for a solution. Einstein once said something about religion, which is so often misquoted that I can say pretty much anything I like here, and you guys will accept it. My memory of the quotation was something like this. There are ages of religion. Some are the religion of children. Others are for adults. What he really said turns out not to apply so well as the actual quote. Because the actual quote says something about religious being childish and goes off about it. So I'm going to go with my quote instead. Consider the metaphysical problems of a three-year-old. And the sort of religion which might address them. I imagine the pattern of a kind of a parent figure who loves you and makes everything safe and good. As an older child, the pattern for rules and consequences might need adding. Maybe the child didn't choose to add the consequences, but that's usually a religion that you might give a child. A teenager may drop the parent figure and may want to drop the rules as well from their religious patterns. A 20-something might actually want the rules back and may well want the parent figure back too. Somewhere along the way, the pattern for rewards for good behavior might have gotten thrown in. I realize this view of our religious quest is almost unusably oversimplified, but I think it's a useful metaphor. As Unitarians, we have many different patterns we might apply to solve our religious problems. We have our seven principles. We have our welcoming congregations. We have our social justice programs and much, much more. Some of us are still battling or deciding whether or not to keep the patterns they might have had from youth. We're still questioning the patterns that Unitarian Universalism sets. And I think that's good. I think questioning it allows us to decide whether we're on autopilot or on purpose. So my question for us is, are we running on autopilot? My answer, not disparagingly, is yes, most of the time. Not because we're not good people, but precisely because we are people. And people do most things on autopilot. How different is the belief in the inherent worth and dignity of every person when it's an active belief, practiced on purpose, than what we just say it and then we don't change anything about the way we act? Can justice be done in belief if the belief in justice, equity, and compassion is just something we do without active intent? Somehow I imagine this is a discussion, only this group, it's a little large for a discussion. However, I'm going to have a little time here. So in closing, I ask each of you to look at the successes you've had in life with the patterns you've come up with so far. Look and see if you could use them better or if they're even the right tools or patterns for you. Look at BOOF and see what we've accomplished here and think about what we could do if we used our tools better. I've badly overused the tool metaphor today, and I'll ask you to forgive me and try it out in your lives.